rebel.
Congratulations.
Can someone hold my koala pouch? Okay.
Just over a year ago, Hollywood actress Rebel Wilson, one of Australia's most recognisable faces, triumphantly walked out of the federal court in Melbourne $4.5 million richer and claiming a moral victory over magazine Women's Day.
But I felt that I had to take a stand. I had to stand up to a bully, a huge media organisation, Bauer Media Group, who maliciously took me down in May 2015 with a series of grubby and completely false articles.
Defamation is a spectre that hangs over every journalist, every time they sit in front of their keyboard. Defamation law attempts to strike a balance between protecting a person's reputation and our freedom of speech. Journalists can fall afoul of the law if they publish words or pictures about another person that courts find to be false or malicious. But don't think you're immune. Now everyone has a publishing platform at their fingertips. If you've ever badmouthed your kid's teacher on Facebook or written a negative review of a restaurant, you too could be drawn into the world of defamation. Rebel Wilson's extraordinary award for damages was later reduced on appeal to $600,000. But the case brought defamation onto the front pages like nothing had before, and the celebrity factor is just the beginning. From the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, this is Please Explain, a weekly podcast where you and I get the full story on some of the most significant issues facing Australia. I'm Tori Maguire. Joining us today are three people who, for their sins, are immersed in defamation law on an almost daily basis. James Chessel is the Group Executive Editor of The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. Lorena Alec is our in-house lawyer. And Kate McClymont, a Walkley Award-winning investigative reporter for The Herald. Welcome all.
Hello.
Thanks, Tori.
Thanks, Tori.
And later I'll be getting business columnist Stephen Bartholomew's to wrap up the wild year on the stock market for us. But first, I'm going to go to you, Lorena. Tell us what happened with Rebel Wilson and why it became such a prominent story.
The Rebel Wilson case was an extraordinary, first-of-its-kind case in Australian law. The principles are very simple, but what happened in the facts of the case were extraordinary. We had a defamation claim by an Australian woman, but also a Hollywood actress, accused of being a serial liar by what some would say was a fairly sort of simple magazine story that wouldn't have raised too many eyebrows, I would have thought. But the result of it was a $4.5 million payout. The magazine couldn't prove truth. They did try and failed. And Rebel was given $4.5 million on the basis that she'd lost movie roles, Hollywood movie roles, and millions of dollars in salary because of the defamation by Women's Day.
And was she able to prove that she actually lost movie roles and that it damaged her?
In the long run, no. So bizarrely, the Supreme Court judge initially said yes, she had lost that money as a result of Women's Day's article. But then when the magazine went on appeal, the appeal court said no, they don't accept that evidence. And they cut her payout all the way down to $600,000. Now, that's still an awful lot of money, but it's nothing like the $4.5 million she initially got.
So that case was the beginning of a sort of public discussion about defamation in this country. Journalists and editors and lawyers have obviously always been involved in it, but it became part of the public consciousness. Why should people care about this? $600,000, James, that doesn't sound like a lot of money for a big media company to pay out to someone that they've, you know, harmed their reputation.
Well, look, $600,000 is a lot of money for a big media company and a lot of money for a medium-sized media company. I think it's really important to say from the outset that when media practitioners talk about defamation, we are not arguing for a minute that you shouldn't be responsible for what you write and you shouldn't be accountable for what you write. And correct the record if you're wrong. We certainly aren't arguing that. What we're saying is over a period of time, Australia in general and Sydney in particular has become the defamation capital of the world. And if you believe in public interest journalism and you believe in the role that investigative journalism such as Kate does, you believe that all that is important, it's becoming very hard to do that. Financially, as an editor, you're in the back of your mind all the time now, you're sitting there going $600,000 here, $1 million there. It adds up, and the defamation and the legal part of our editorial budgets has been growing as a proportion of the overall budget for several years now, and it's now in the many millions of dollars.
And what about all the costs for cases that don't even have a payout? I mean, how much are we spending on just making sure we don't get sued, or B, defending sometimes successfully?
It's millions of dollars every year. And that's millions of dollars that we're not spending on journalism, that we're not spending on cadets coming out of journalism school, that we're not spending on time to investigate the big stories that are that we, you know, get leads on. We're not having those resources. Instead, those resources are being siphoned off into, you know, strategic lawyers like me.
And it's also the time and emotional costs when you are being sued. At the moment, I've got 4 defamation cases. I have had 2 others this year. You know, one dropped off. One was suing me for suggesting that he was corrupt, and then ICAC announced an investigation into his activities. I was like, yes! But the amount of time I spend with our lawyers, you know, having to prove all these things, and every story I write, I now have to think of it as what happens when this goes to court, because a lot of investigative journalism deals with confidential sources, and I have to say to myself, well, if my whole story is confidential sources, which one of those people will be willing to forgo their their privacy to come forward and stand up in court? And that's often what makes defending these actions really difficult, is trying to get people to come and say, look, I took cocaine with this person, or I was there when I saw a criminal offence happen. Those people often don't want to come forward because they're opening themselves to collusion, sometimes in a criminal activity themselves. So defamation is a minefield for journalism.
And has it always been like that, or do you think it's worse?
Well, I mean, I think for our listeners, we should actually point out that while it seems that there is an absolute rush of either celebrities suing media outlets, in fact, the majority of defamation cases are what's known in the industry as backyarders, and that is people suing each other. For instance, there was a $105,000 payout for a music teacher at Orange High School because her student had been posting – well, sorry, it was never her student, but a student at the school had been posting these outrageous lies because somehow this music teacher had replaced his father as the music teacher.
That was on Twitter, wasn't it?
I think it was on Facebook.
Right.
And there are, you know, successful actions of former spouses making – unwarranted and untrue statements about their spouse. So, in fact, our readers should think before they post. Like,
it's a really good point, because the defamation laws as they currently stand were formulated before Twitter was a thing, before Instagram was a thing, and Facebook had only just started. So the petty neighbourhood disputes that you once had over the back fence are now take place over Facebook, potentially, as Kate said, open you up to vexatious defamation fronts. But to answer your original question, Tori, it most definitely has got worse. I think litigants are emboldened. I think the judges, while they have difficult jobs, have perhaps lost sight of what it is, the pressures on newsrooms to come up with news and the processes that newsrooms go through. So there's a real environment now where any slight, no matter how serious it is given legal attention when perhaps it shouldn't.
Right. So, Lorena, what happens when someone sues for defamation? What's the first step?
The first step is usually what's called a concerns notice, which is a notice of their concerns about the article. What it actually is usually a legal letter that says, this story that you wrote on this date says these terrible things about my client, and we're going to sue you. We then have 28 days, any publisher, be they a corporate publisher or actually a person who's written something on Facebook, has 28 days to provide what's called an offer to make amends. So the defamation law provides this sort of way to try and resolve the dispute, where the publisher can offer to write a correction and publish it in the same sort of prominence, the same place as the original publication, and also to pay their costs if they've lawyered up. But that then gets tested if they then sue us anyway. We could say, well, we gave you an offer to make amends. That gives us a defence. But it's only a defence if it was fully reasonable as a way of resolving the entire dispute. And lo and behold, usually an amount of money has to change hands as well. That's where things fall down. There's only been one case that I'm aware of where an offer to make amends was upheld. It was a case that I actually ran, and I won it the first time around, and then we lost on appeal.
Right.
The amount of money just wasn't enough.
So what was the amends that you made?
So we offered a correction, costs, they are the two necessary elements, and an amount of money, but the Court of Appeals held that amount of money wasn't enough to be a reasonable offer to resolve it.
Right.
And so the whole defence fell down. So basically we're being asked in those first 28 days to put a correct figure on how much this will be worth in 2 years' time when it gets to trial. And without knowing much about the plaintiff's background, their personal circumstances, how hurt their feelings are, how many people they know contacted them about the article, those are the things that affect the amount of money they're going to get paid.
Craig McLaughlin, and I'm also a party to that action, I think he told the court the other day that he's seeking $6 million in lost earnings.
So what should, I mean, before we get into the nitty-gritty on for publishers, what should an ordinary person who's put a Facebook comment that slanders someone do when they get one of those letters?
It's really difficult because the person who publishes things like that believes it. And just like any journalist, we write things that we believe are true. No one's running around writing lies just for the hell of it. But it's so difficult to have to say, look, I think the safest thing to do is take it down, delete it, back down, and pray they don't sue you. Because the fact is, if for any member of the public, if you get sued, you could lose your house.
And certainly they wouldn't have gone through the editorial process of standing up a story the way that we do.
That's right. Well, we talk about, you know, damages payouts of $105,000 for a school student or $600,000 for a publishing company. It's the costs as well. So if you lose, you have to pay your own lawyer's fees. You also have to pay the plaintiff's lawyer's fees. In the Stephen Dank case, I was acting for News Corp in defending
that. Just remind us who he was.
So Stephen Dank was the sports scientist who was accused of giving banned substances.
Peptides
and other banned substances to football players. He sued the Daily Telegraph for writing stories along that exact line, and the Telegraph successfully defended it. Now, there were some meanings that were conveyed and were defamatory, but he got literally a damages award of zero because of so much of those stories were true, and we proved they were true. But News Corp incurred $2 million defending that case.
And the irony is a lot of people that win defamation cases find themselves almost out of pocket, don't they? Because the amount of money that flows to their barristers and their solicitors is huge. So it doesn't, it's the old joke, the people that profit out of it are the lawyers.
But also it's interesting about journalism in itself, because I think it's almost impossible to do investigative journalism as a freelancer if you haven't got the backing of a major company. For instance, when Stephen Mayne, who's a shareholder activist, he was also the founder of online news website Crikey. He lost his house when he was sued over a single paragraph in a story, and he went down in a screaming heap over, you know, basically one paragraph. And it wasn't that egregious, but that's what can happen to you.
So, Lorena, if we get sued and we have end up in court because we can't settle it, what are our available defences?
So the obvious first defence is truth. But the problem is for any publisher, professional or amateur, the problem is proving truth. So the publisher's got to prove that the story that we wrote was true and substantially true.
Which is different to other jurisdictions, isn't it?
That's right. So in America, the plaintiff, the person complaining, has to prove the story about them was false. But here we have to prove our story was true. And that sort of, on its face, seems fair enough. We wrote the story. We take responsibility for what we write. But what we, the information we're given when we're writing a story to give us the belief that the story is true and worthy and of public interest are often not enough for a judge. That's because we're relying on confidential sources who we can't put in the witness box. We're relying on documents we've been shown, but we weren't given copies of. We're relying on other information that, you know, third parties may have, and then the court won't let us issue a subpoena. It says, oh, you're just fishing.
Right.
But if it's fishing, it's harpooning, because we know exactly what it is and we know exactly where it is and we want to have it, please. And the judge will still say no.
So is it possible for us to go and do more journalism and more reporting to try and stand up a story for further for a court proceeding after we've published it?
As the law stands, we should be able to, but the problem we've found is, particularly with issuing subpoenas, which is the best way to get admissible evidence from third parties, the courts have been denying us that. And we've also had fights over discovery. So when the plaintiff says, this story you wrote about my personal life is false, the person who has the documents to show whether it's true or false is the plaintiff. So we would ask for discovery of the documents from the plaintiff about their lives, and they refuse to give them to us. And then we take them to court, and the judge will not make an order letting us have that material.
Sometimes it does work in reverse, and I think of the famous case of then Labor MP Craig Thompson suing Fairfax Media, as we were then. But during the course of that, what came back in the subpoenas was even more astonishing than what we had initially written about his use of prostitutes. And it was basically using union money to pay for these prostitutes. So we got, travel documents, we got receipts, and he ended up dropping the case because it became completely evident that not only what we wrote was true, but there was so much more to back it up. And you wonder, in those cases, what could be in your mind to take a defamation case? And that often happens, is that people sue, and then what does come out in discovery is so bad for their case.
Do you think that would happen now, though?
Yeah, no, it can happen.
Yeah.
Well, I've seen, we've certainly got cases on foot where people have sued and you just think, the plaintiff doesn't realise they've done anything wrong. In their own mind, they know what happened, but they don't think it was that bad.
They think we can't prove it.
Yeah, and that's the worst part. If they know it's actually substantially true and they just think we can't prove it. That's like so gutsy. Part of me can't even believe
gutsy
people would
or crazy.
That.
I'm thinking of Eddie Obeid.
Well, wanted to talk about this. Tell us about that, Kate.
As your lawyer, can I encourage you to go right ahead?
No, well, this was as a result of a 2002 story, which was essentially into the Bulldogs Rugby League Club and the Liverpool Council joining forces to do a development together. They were going to build a stadium and the council chambers, they're all going to move in together. But there was a key piece of Crown land that they needed. And Eddie Obeid was approached. We had four different sources who each said to us that Eddie Obeid asked for $1 million, not for himself, but $1 million to go to the Labor Party. And it was to be structured in fees of the chosen developer doing the stadium. It was all worked out how it was going to be paid. And we had one person who was a confidential source came forward and gave evidence. But the other three, one of them was a colleague of Eddie Obeid's who also knew about it. We couldn't get them over the line. The other politician gave evidence behind closed doors. But ultimately, the judge felt that we had relied on hearsay and found for Eddie Obeid. And, you know, the story was suggesting that Eddie Obeid was a corrupt politician. And every time I think of that court case, I really want to cry.
And where is Eddie Obeid now, Kate?
He's playing cards in Berrima Jail.
Well, and why is he in jail? Because he was, in fact,
a corrupt politician.
Okay. The other issue that we have with truth, and correct me if I'm wrong, Lorena, but is the imputations issue, where you can end up defending something that you didn't actually say in the article. So the litigant will say, oh, well, you implied I was a crook or a spy or something. And even though we went to great trouble to say, actually, we're saying this person is this or that, they're saying the imputation of what you wrote was that crook or spy.
Yeah, that's right.
And then you're in this kind of bizarre world where you're arguing something you didn't believe in the first place to try and get this truth defense.
Yeah, that's right. It's a very warped sort of way that these cases play out. So there's the article itself, like the newspaper page or the Facebook post, whatever it is put in front of the court, and that's what we're going to be arguing about. But what then becomes the topic of debate for days and days of the trial and the basis of the judgment is the imputations, the meanings that arise from that article. So you may have an 800-word article, but they may have 10 different meanings that they've plucked from it that they say is from, you know, these paragraphs here convey this. These paragraphs at the end combined with that headline convey something else. And you end up with all these very highly pitched meanings that don't resemble really the article that we wrote. They certainly were not the meanings we intended to convey, but the publisher's intention is completely irrelevant.
So as a lawyer who's vetting these stories before they get published, are you having to get more and more imaginative in what you think the imputations of a story might be?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm looking at it from a plaintiff's lawyer's point of view every time we do one of our stories. So even though I'm acting for the publisher, I'm reviewing it like I'm the plaintiff's lawyer and saying, what are the meanings that come from this and how could we prove they're true? But there are other defences like public documents. We're allowed to do a fair report of those. Public proceedings like Parliament or a court hearing. Exactly. We're allowed to do fair reports of those. But we've even been sued over those sorts of stories because the people in the story don't believe what we wrote about them was fairly done.
Okay.
They don't like the way we wrote it. And so we end up spending hundreds of thousands of dollars arguing about what were the meanings that came from that story. Are they really as high as the plaintiff wants to pitch them? Can we prove those high-pitched meanings are true? And can we prove those high-pitched meanings are actually still in a fair report of that court hearing or that parliamentary sitting?
So just finally, if things don't change and we keep having to spend all this money and on defending things that we haven't even necessarily implied, are we going to be able to keep doing investigations and big public interest stories?
We will continue to do that, but we will be selective about how we do it, just for financial reasons, unfortunately, and that is the bottom line. I think a really one thing we've probably forgotten to mention, it's a really important point, particularly for people who are listening to this going, well, just do your jobs, get it right, and none of this would be a problem. And this goes to your question about how we can reform the laws, and I don't have an easy answer to this, but one of the interesting things that's been written about recently, given defamation's been in the news, is how does defamation encompass a lot of the sexual harassment allegations that are being made at the moment. So if you're looking for a concrete example of where the law needs to better be able to kind of anticipate and deal with really complicated, difficult stories, and Kate's written a lot about this when you're dealing with women who, A, probably haven't found their names in the public domain and they didn't put them out there in the first place, B, often would prefer to be speaking anonymously rather than publicly. And then when they find themselves having to defend things or say things about people that have allegedly harassed them, then face the prospect of being sued. It really is a system where you think, gosh, it doesn't work. It doesn't work for these people, and it needs to work better for them. We saw that with Foley and New South Wales government here, and I don't know, it's a hard one to reform because you're talking about a lot of nuance and a lot of grey areas there, but we do need to get to a place when people have important things to say and serious things to say, they can say it with some degree of freedom. Otherwise, journalism won't be able to do what it's meant to do.
Well, thanks so much for joining me, James, Lorena, Kate. Have a Merry Christmas, and hopefully we won't see any of you in court too soon.
Thanks, Dan.
Thanks, Dory.
Hi, I'm Michael Batchelard. I'm the Investigations and Foreign Editor at The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald have by far the country's biggest investigations teams, breaking stories about corruption, crime, and social and political issues. We also have foreign correspondents in Asia, China, Europe, and the US. Both are expensive but crucial to providing news for and by Australians that help our readers interpret the world. And if people value that, we need people to subscribe so we can keep doing it. Subscribers allow us to dig deeper into the important stories that matter to our readers.
In 2018, despite the novel and quite erratic nature of the Trump presidency, was one of the least volatile in US share market history, until about October, when volatility returned with a vengeance. Stephen Bartholomew is our senior business columnist and keeps a sharp eye on the markets for our readers. Steve, this is the last week before Christmas in 2018. Can you start by giving me your thoughts about how things have gone on the financial markets this year?
They started pretty well. If you think about Wall Street as being kind of the epicentre of global markets, so Wall Street always provides direction for the rest of the world. For most of the year, Wall Street was raging. We had an absolute bull market, particularly in technology stocks, partly fueled by the Trump tax cuts and spending. There was a huge sort of infusion of profitability into the US corporate sector. So corporate earnings in these states were running at about 20% above last year's. Now, that's a kind of a one-off because it wanes over time. And so next year, the expectation is corporate profits in the US will drop to, growth in them will drop to about 5%. For most of this year, US corporate profits were hot. Technology stocks were red hot. And then all of a sudden, very late September, as the trade conflict with China suddenly sort of exploded, it had been simmering away, and then it exploded with tit-for-tat tariff impositions. That gave the market a real shock. And if you look at the US market, and ours for that matter, they nosedived ever since then. The US market's basically wiped out all its gains since September last year. Our market still hasn't got anywhere close to the peak it had before the financial crisis, but has actually fallen more this year than the US market. On the back of, clearly, the banks and Telstra are the larger part of our market, and it hasn't been a good year for the banks or Telstra. So you get 9 months where the markets are running really, really well, and then all of a sudden it hit a brick wall.
So do you think this is the beginning of a long period of pain?
I think it's the beginning of a long period of volatility. I mean, you referred to it earlier. We hadn't had a less volatile period in that, from the start of the year through to September, for a decade. And then all of a sudden it exploded because all of a sudden you had these sort of great uncertainties around the markets. And trade's the big one, but the other one, of course, is the Federal Reserve. What happens to interest rates in the States and what happens to the sort of the flow of money into US markets. The Fed's been withdrawing liquidity from the markets, so it shrinks its balance sheet. It's not reinvesting the proceeds of the maturing securities that it bought through its what they call quantitative easing programs, where it's bought $3.6 trillion worth of bonds and mortgages. Now they're not reinvesting those. So that pile, that $3.6 billion pile, is shrinking at about $50 billion US a month. So that takes liquidity out of the market.
So what would have driven their decision to do that?
They tried to normalise US monetary policy. It was a very abnormal period this last decade, both in the US and Europe and to a degree Japan. They did unconventional things like buying bonds and mortgages to keep rates very low and to pump liquidity into the system. They're trying to normalise, so they're withdrawing that liquidity, very, very cheap liquidity. So that's disappearing from the system very steadily. And at the same time, they've been raising rates. So we've had 9 increases in the Fed funds rate since they started this process in December 2015. So the markets are much more sensitive now to the notion that the Fed might continue to raise rates and maybe raise them to a level which is too high, at the same time as the impact of the Trump tax cuts and spending starts to wane and the US economy starts to slow. So there's a potential for an overreaction from the Fed, which drives a recession in the States sometime in the next 2 years. And the market has suddenly become more sensitive to that possibility.
Let's talk about the Australian banks for a minute. As you said, understatement of the year that they've had a rough time. What do you predict for next year as how they're going to be able to settle down after the Banking Royal Commission releases its findings and whether they're actually going to be able to become reliable investments for people again?
I think at some point in future they'll become reliable, not for exciting investments for people again. I don't think it's going to be next year. I think next year we're going to see the continuing fallout from the damage that's already been done by the Royal Commission, not just to their reputation, but to the psychology of the bankers. If you talk to any business, large or small, or individuals who've gone to their bank looking for a loan in the last month or two, they'll tell you it's almost impossible to get one. Doesn't matter how credit worthy you might be, the banks are so scared, particularly of the responsible lending issues that were highlighted in before the Royal Commission. They're so scared that they're going to be caught up be caught by these far more aggressive regulators they've now got, who've also been shaken up by the Royal Commission, that they're basically doing very little. And so there's a real prospect of a severe credit crunch. One's already kind of emerging, but it could get significantly worse coming into 2019. We'll see the impact of it in 2019. So if you look at banks as an investment, there won't be any volume growth for them because they're just not writing enough new loans to get real volume growth. They face significantly increased costs as a result of the Royal Commission, even before the Royal Commission's recommendations have been aired. Higher costs, flat revenues, profitability gets squeezed. And that looks to be the sort of the near to medium term future outlook for the banks. It's not very exciting, and there's potentially further downside as the calls for more and more remediation come through.
The energy sector has also been through a lot of political turmoil. There's a lot of uncertainty for those companies.
If you look at the big miners, so the BHPs and Rios, they've had a pretty good year. In fact, a very good year, mainly because the commodity prices, particularly iron ore and coal, were quite elevated, surprisingly, through this year. They are, however, heavily exposed to China, as indeed the entire resource sector is, including energy, heavily exposed to China at a time when China's growth has slowed quite considerably and will slow even further if they can't diffuse the tariff tensions with the US, which would mean surrender for the Chinese, which is kind of unlikely, which means 2019, the outlook for China is really, really messy, quite cloudy. And therefore, that flows back into what your expectations might be about commodity prices and therefore the fortunes of BHP and Rio and the like. In terms of the energy companies, so oil and gas companies, that's even more hard to predict because we saw prices soar above $80 US a barrel. We saw them plummet below $60 US a barrel all in the space of about a few weeks. OPEC's trying to get some stability back in the market by agreeing to cut production. But the announcement of that production cut had no effect on the markets. So I think that if you're an investor, you look at the world and you say, the US is likely to have lower growth next year than they did this year. Europe, some parts of Europe have had negative growth in the last couple of quarters, including Germany. So the outlook for Europe is a bit more subdued and maybe a little bit on the negative side. China slowing, which means the greater Asia will slow. So the outlook for the global economy is actually a fairly sombre one. And compared to a relatively sombre 2018, it's going to be worse. So you wouldn't be too enthusiastic about the outlook for investors generally.
So I would never ask you for investment advice, Steve, but for people whose income does rely on their investments this Christmas, should they be drinking champagne or local sparkling?
I'd tend to be on the conservative side. I'd be drinking the local stuff.
All right. Well, you have a wonderful Christmas. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Tori.
Just a quick note to say Please Explain isn't taking a break for Christmas and New Year. Keep checking your feed over the holidays because we'll have some special episodes for you. Thanks to our guests this episode, Kate McClymont, Lorena Alec, James Chessel and Stephen Bartholomews. We all know word of mouth is the best way to find out about a new podcast. So if you know someone who should love Please Explain, help them find the pod. We're keen to hear how you're finding the season too. You can email the team via the link in the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age websites. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. Subscribing to our news service gets you unlimited access to award-winning independent journalism and great behind-the-scenes content you can't get anywhere else. Follow the link in our show bio to get a subscription today. This episode was produced and edited by David Escort and Rachel Dexter, technical assistance from David McMillan, and Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. I'm Tori Maguire. Thanks for listening.